recording, so I'll keep it on. So what am I, where to start? Okay. What am I going to tell you? It's looking very funny, actually, for me to sit according to the schedule that I'll probably be giving the conservative talk of the meeting. That doesn't always happen. So on that note, you know, in order to make it more fun and interactive, I mean, I do wish to invite you to ask questions. Philosophy of this whole thing and questioning it is also, you know, welcome, except a lot of philosophical diatribes should wait until the end when I at least finish with the technical details. So what do I want to talk about? Well, you know, the fact that we live in a weird universe and, you know, this whole dark business, I don't think I need to sell you that, because if you were in dire need of that, you wouldn't be here now, okay? I'll remind you a little bit of the ideas concerning the landscape, specifically as they relate to the solution to the cosmological constant problem. Okay, and I'll discuss to some extent the you know, string theory incarnation of the landscape at the level of the Busov-Polchinski-Per model. Okay, I'm not going to go into, you know, deep details of how you do this and fix that and so on and so forth. I'll ignore that. But then what I'll do is, in fact, I'll argue that within the set of rules adopted by Busov and Polchinski, okay, same set of rules, there are in fact terms in the same type of constructions which, when turned on with the same set of assumptions as they do, so remember, the assumptions they have is basically that some miracle can stabilize all the dilatonic moduli, okay, leaving around a lot of form fields and possibly some light axioms. Okay, I'll tell you that these sets of rules naturally yield quintessential coordinates where some of these axiom fields can actually behave just like quintessence models if, all right, you start with the right fluxes of the form forms and so on and so forth. So I'll discuss the mechanism in some amount of detail, and I'll try to give you a, how should I put it? I'll try to point to a corner, okay, of, you know, string theory where such dynamics can be naturally realized, okay? As a sort of caveat, so far we haven't yet been able to find an actual full embedding, although we are still searching for it. One thing I can tell you is there are no, in principle, no-go theorems prohibiting it. And at the end, I'll actually be able to share a few insights as to what might be necessary to be found before we can actually realize that in a quote-unquote fully controllable, how should I call it, neighborhood, okay, of the actual string landscape. All right, so here is basically why we are here, right? We are here because of the fact that we are but a tiny fraction of the population of the universe. Right? I mean, if you actually are an astronomer looking at the sky and whatnot, that's perhaps not too surprising. The only surprising thing is that when you look at the sky and you realize how, you know, insignificant you appear to be, okay, and then you actually do mass counts and so on and so forth, you realize you're even more insignificant. And so what we have been doing is basically trying to parameterize our insignificance with coming up with all kinds of things that can behave like this mysterious dark energy and dark matter. Perhaps a way of actually summarizing the story appropriately, okay, instead of, you know, taxonomizing various details and whatnot, is to, you know, really realize that the time has come to discuss where the peaks have been. Okay? If you like, much of model building has basically been like that. What's the issue? What's the problem? I have my own idiosyncrasy about why. You know, what really goes wrong, but I think I'm going to refrain from discussing it in detail here. Here are just some sort of gists and aspects of this. If you think about lambda, okay, it is actually particularly interesting to view it from the thermodynamic point of view, especially because of the ongoing thinking and conjectures and ideas that try to interpret general relativity as some kind of a thermodynamic limit of some fundamental theory and so on and so forth. Okay? in a certain sense, the lambda problem is very similar to something that we are actually familiar with in thermodynamics. Okay? In thermodynamics, when you define the concept of entropy, you use the second law, which is a differential equation. You say that the ds is equal to du divided by t, right? Where t is, of course, your intensive property of the system and so on and so forth. And then you know, if you want to define entropy as a macroscopic measure of a thermodynamic system, you need to integrate that. And that means you get an integration constant. And then the question is, what is that integration constant? And of course, you want to know it because you want to, you know, assign an actual meaning to entropy of the thermodynamic system as a measure of the system complexity. And so the question is, when you're talking about system complexity, you then want to have a precise definition of the correlation of the connection between entropy and the system complexity relative to some background in which you're calculating what that system complexity may be. And the way we deal with this issue, okay, in pure thermodynamics, right? So no kinetic theory quite yet, is we invoke this third law of thermodynamics, which is actually, in the realm of thermodynamics itself, nothing but a postulate. Okay? We call it Nernst theorem because of the fact that actually Nernst proved it for certain systems for which he had at least some toy model microscopic description. But the idea was basically that we should say the postulate tells us essentially that that integration constant is zero. That's what the postulate really means. Okay? You know, the entropy of a pure substance approaches zero as the absolute temperature approaches zero. That essentially just tells you that if you write down ds equals t du and integrate as you take the limit t goes to zero, you are actually finding that the total entropy goes to zero. And because you're thinking that, at least in classical physics, the complexity, you know, encoded in motion ceases when you extract all the kinetic energy from there, in other words, set temperature to zero, then what you're calculating in that limit is in fact that integration constant, and then that being set to zero. Okay. Now, to prove this, we actually need to go beyond thermodynamics. We need to do better than thermodynamics. We need kinetic theory. We need statistical mechanics. So from this point of view, and there is many reasons to make this parallel a little bit more precise when you apply it to general relativity and cosmological constants. One way to think about it is unimodular gravity. Another way to think about it, where probably some people have heard or looked at this paper by Jacobson called Einstein's equations of state or something like that, right? Where he basically derives Einstein's equations from black hole thermodynamics, postulating that a black hole is a thermodynamic system in equilibrium. And then from the second law of thermodynamics, integrating it backward to resurrect, if you like, Einstein's equation. If you look very carefully in that paper, you'll actually realize that he doesn't derive Einstein's equation. He derives the projection of Einstein's equations from horizon generators of the black hole. So he derives g mu nu minus t mu nu projected on the tangent vectors to the horizon, okay, to be equal to zero. Now, that's almost Einstein's equations, but there is an integration constant lurking in there. Because if you actually put in a constant times g mu nu when you projected the null generators, you get zero. And that integration constant does come in. What he really derives is g mu nu equals t mu nu plus a constant times the method. Okay, so there is that integration constant that you need to get in some other way that the classical theory does not, you know, offer you an immediate solution to the puzzle. In light of that, the real question that remains is that once you take this, okay, as an actual fact that is built into general relativity itself, can you at least desensitize your low energy physics from the ignorance of the microphysics that is necessary to set that constant to whichever value you prefer? Okay, in other words, the legitimate question is, once you're given the integration constant that you can tune to match whatever your friend the astronomer gives you, can you at least make sure that that choice of integration constant does not have to be dramatically altered by order one modification of that classical number once you put in one loop correction to whatever you call the quantum part of the vacuum energy, okay? That is the one unique problem, okay, of cosmological constant that is actually legitimate from the point of view of conventional general relativity. And that is the problem that so far we have essentially failed flat on the nose attempting to solve. All right? Except with this, right? So, you know, I mean, I'm not going to go too much in my opinions about the philosophy of the landscape and entropics, okay? You know, I'll remind you of the little statement that Weinberg is credited for uttering, which is that people who, you know, if you complain too much about it, there is a danger, right? That you can be likened to a priest who complains about pornography. No matter how much you complain about it, okay, somebody will think you're taking too much interest in it. So being as one of such, you know, complainers, okay, one thing that is at least interesting is to actually ask questions about the possible benefits from this. Because you see, even with pornography, I mean, some of it actually gets interpreted as erotic art and it gets sent to museums where we go and pay, you know, hefty admissions fee to admire it. So perhaps it's one of these applications where, you know, we actually use this kind of landscape argumentation in order to help alleviate the immediate pain from not being able to fix this sensitivity to the missing physics. How does it do that? How does landscape really work? Okay, so the point is, when we actually, what we measure, what we call cosmological constant, is in fact a sort of combined effect from various corners of dynamics. The only thing that we really measure, okay, that we can sort of talk of as an actual observable, independent of how we separate the system into subsystems that we use as, you know, calculational tools for certain contributions and so on and so forth, is the actual curvature of the vacuum state of the universe. Okay, that's the thing that feeds in ordinary general relativity, that's the thing that feeds in the Einstein's equation and generates the curvature of the space at the largest scale. Okay, that piece in turn is in fact the sum of, you know, whatever the classical integration constant is, like this Jacobson or unimodular or whatever term. Okay, and the leading plus subleading order. Okay, once you choose your classical space, then you basically populate your classical space with a quantum field theory, okay, which is ultimately just a system of oscillators, and due to uncertainty principle, they actually do contribute in any interacting theory, which is an important thing to stress, right? They contribute some extra corrections to what we call vacuum energy. And then we, of course, calculate it, you know, in the semi-classical approach by basically thinking of the vacuum as the background as fixed and computing the expectation value of stress energy tensor of the field theory in that vacuum. And we deal with all the issues that that entails. And it is highly non-trivial, as we know. But there are also methods to do it with some, you know, adoption of cutoffs and regularization procedures. Then what we do is to set this term to zero as required by phenomenology, right? As required by observation. We take whatever our quantum calculation gives us, and we then choose the classical part to cancel it all but a tiny amount. Okay? So the idea of the naturalness approach, okay, of, you know, if we had something akin to you know, some dynamics that addresses the hierarchy problem for the Higgs mass, then ideally we would like to basically make sure that this term is essentially determined by leading loop calculation or in fact classical expectation value alone. All right. If we had that, then we could basically make our choice of the lambda classical once and be done with it. Then, you know, in all the subleading, it's basically like calculating the Higgs mass, all right, in some supersymmetric model with low scale supersymmetry breaking. you calculate it, you know it needs to be 100 and whatever, 14 GB or somewhere near there, okay? Then, of course, you know that if you just take the standard model loops, well, it's not going to be corrected that much except by the top, but you do get sensitive to whatever other physics there may be above the Higgs scale, okay? And in order to prevent your sensitivity to that, you postulate supersymmetry broken only at the PEV, and then supersymmetry serves as a custodian, making sure that the large corrections to the Higgs masses are automatically thrown out of the story, okay? And then whatever you calculate is essentially at the classical level, up to small corrections, more or less remains unaffected, okay? Here, we don't know how to do that. This term in the loop expansion always gets order one correction. In other words, all loops seem to matter. So the possibility then, well, what that means then is if you want to keep tuning down loop by loop, you have to basically keep choosing a different classical part, classical contribution, after every, you know, perturbative correction in your quantum field theory, which is highly uncomfortable and highly discomfortable. So one other option is to say, look, and this is how landscape really works. That's the idea, right? If this classical variable is really a random variable, it can be this here and that over there and so on and so forth, then you say, well, you know, however deep I went into my loop expansion, somewhere in this ensemble of classically allowed values for lambda classical, you'll find the right one, which will cancel whatever, you know, whatever lambda quantum you chose to stop at, okay? And then, of course, you need basically to have a uniform distribution for the classical value, such that you can argue that it's not impossible to cancel whatever quantum value you get after, you know, n loops in the large n limit. And this is accomplished with the introduction of the, if you like, dynamical cosmological constant, in other words, the four-form field, which has no local dynamics, but essentially contributes to vacuum energy just like a cosmological constant, except that it can change from place to place by the emission of membrane. And so if you, you know, imagine that you have some humongous spatial slice that the universe is only a small neighborhood of, the universe that we see, that we inhabit, then in that spatial slice, due to the emission membranes and sometimes even absorption of membranes from infinity, of course, okay, you'll end up basically having a whole random distribution of the fluxes of the four forms, and therefore essentially random a distribution of the effective classical values of lambda. And then basically you should just look for the neighborhood, okay, where you can fit our own universe to the given order in your loop expansion calculation of the lambda quantum, okay? And because you're assuming a priori uniform distribution of the classical values, then you need to be very clever about inventing an argument of why you actually ended up, you know, how you favored just the right one, the one that you need. And, you know, from this point of view, if you truly have a uniform a priori distribution, then in fact, actually, the Weak entropic principle doesn't even look like such nonsense anyway. It simply tells you, look, you know, don't ask too much about a priori probability of getting the right universe. Just remember that if you didn't, you wouldn't be here to ask the question. Of course, you may also take that to be an ultimate capitulation in the face of an overwhelming enemy, which, you know, may be true. The bottom line is that the trouble with the dynamical cancellation, you know, with this random variable, is that you need to get out of a theory that produces numbers order one times the cutoff, whatever you think the cutoff is, you know, TeV or M Planck or whatever, you need to produce numbers which are tremendously smaller, okay? If you say that the cutoff is TeV, okay, then you need to find ways of actually, so for that means if the cutoff is PEV, then basically your random variable should essentially change in the natural simple realizations by terms that are afforded one times the cutoff. Okay? And that's obviously not good enough. Because if that's all you've got, then you will still have to fine tune the classical value to be 10 to the minus 60 times the cutoff. Okay? So what you do is you actually produce, you populate your theory with lots of foreign fields pointing in different directions in some sort of isospace. Okay? And you postulate that they have charges which are not exactly commensurable, where basically the ratio of charges isn't a rational number. Okay? But they're irrational. And if that's the case, then in the phase space of possible solution, okay, you can actually end up with flux configurations which are arbitrarily close to any given value of classical lambda that you wish to cancel. Sorry, quantum lambda that you wish to cancel. Okay? And that puts in constraints and requirements in the theory. You know, you have to have, given a cutoff, you have to have lots of form fields. And the argument is that at least in at least in dimensional reduction of supergravities that come from string theory, you do get lots of form fields. Okay? And then, you know, once these sort of ingredients are there, one might say the rest of it is basically the question of your technical ability of, you know, finding the right solutions in this, you know, vast phase space, where in fact the favorable type of dynamics can be realized. And that you know, there is many interesting questions that you can ask there, okay? You know, I already mentioned this measure of probability a priori proof. That's a difficult thing, okay? There is, as I understand it, there is actually some ways of making interesting statements about this. But still, you know, a fair bit of the definition of probability in cosmology, you know, without having real quantum cosmology, quantum gravity, whatever, answering the a priori questions is going to be awfully difficult. Okay? A posteriori measures at some level involve entropy. Okay, and then, you know, let's put it this way. I find it very hard to argue against the weak entropic principle. I mean, the only way to argue against the weak entropic principle in consistent way is to come up with an alternative dynamical explanation which needs none, no entropics, okay? It's like, you know, it's not a conflict of theory, it's a conflict of ideology, okay? However, the fact that this exists as a way of explaining away the large cosmological constant by diversity, okay? You know, this is how it works, right? It's by diversity. Then it has led some people to make strong claims. In particular, Raphael has gone on the record by basically saying that, you know, the fact that this is the only fully consistent way with which we can answer what lambda is, rather what it is not, okay? That it is not large, and the fact that we have some, you know, toy model realization of these dynamics, and the fact that this has in fact been realized at some level in string theory compactification, should make us think that in fact what we now see, you know, or rather our astronomer friends see and tell us, is really cosmological constant. Okay, in other words, guys, don't waste your time with quintessence. Don't waste your time with alternative explanations. Don't waste your time. That's it. Okay? W is equals to minus one. Do not spend, I don't know, gazillion million dollars, you know, building satellites and dedicated missions to measure the equation state of dark energy and so on and so forth. We know what. Right? Now you can take that however you want. Right? But an interesting question is this really true? So in fact, perhaps a simple way to check that would be to examine exactly the same framework to see whether it actually really unambiguously tells that whatever you end up with as your low energy vacuum is dark energy with W equals minus 1 or not? Okay, then at least in this very restrictive but well-posed, well-defined mini toy framework, you know whether such strong claims make sense or not. Okay, so what I'll tell you is that, in fact, in the toy model setup of Boos and Polchinski, actually, just a second, W equals minus 1 is not unique to energy 1. Go ahead.
The only prediction of the landscape picture is that W must be minus 1, because it obviously doesn't predict the lambda.
That's what he thought. Well, yes, but you see again, remember the anthropic landscape.
Sure, sure.
You're not supposed to do that. I'll give you later an example why I actually don't think that's illegitimate.
Mm-hmm. But my point is that, so that suggestion is funny, because that's really the only prediction, and it's suggesting not to test that prediction.
That's correct. That's correct. That is not completely legitimate. I'll tell you, bring this up when I'm done, again, because there is actually an example involving unification and supersymmetry, which is actually adequate.
Well, W can be minus 1 from cosmological constant, but you can find something else on top of it
that
changes it.
Of course.
And which would be natural.
Of course. Exactly. But, you know, let's not worry about, you see, the way he predicts that to be small is by reproducing a theory with a small step. It just doesn't predict you, doesn't give you a firm 100% unambiguous, you know, deterministic prediction that it must be that now here. It just tells you there is a step which is 10 to the minus 120. And if you didn't end up in a place where only that small, tiny, misalignment didn't get canceled, you wouldn't be here to ask the question. So that's not so bad. Okay? It can be a lot worse.
But the statement that we shouldn't test for W
exactly.
Minus 1 is garbage, right?
Let me put it this way.
You should phrase it as
testing. Let me put it this way.
Physics at the scale.
Again, let's not talk about philosophy. What I want to show is not to say that it's garbage. I want to prove it. Okay? So here is how you actually prove it. All right. Start with basically the same. Well, here is a toy model. Okay. Here is a sort of toy model Boos-Polchinski landscape after dimensional reduction to 4 dimensions, with the assumption that the volume moduli are stabilized, and with the addition of an extra term. And I'll tell you where that term comes from if you start with M theory, or rather 11D supergravity. Einstein term, 4-4, put in a massless axiom, a pseudo number Goldstone. Okay, I'll call them axioms, but they're not QCD, right? And now put in one extra term. Okay, this term is not prohibited by symmetries. There is nothing that tells you it cannot be there. It doesn't look particularly appetizing on first sight, okay? I mean, but you see that basically it's, you know, since this is a pseudo-scalar, you can take the 4 form, which is a real tensor, contract it with epsilon, and this is completely kosher. No problem. Putin also, allow F to be sort of, give it global dynamics by throwing in some membranes in the theory that can be nucleated and alter the value of F from place to place. Now, if you actually want to properly covariantize this in the presence of membranes which act like boundaries in space between different regions, you have to add in some Gibbons-Hawking terms, Gibbons-Hawking-like terms, in order to have correct variational principle. Okay? All right. It looks like that, but that's deceiving. I'll show you what it is. It's a master. This is a master, and I'll give you the intuitive argument in a moment, and you'll understand it immediately. But now, first, I'll just show I'm not lying by actually playing with the equation. So the point is, you basically vary this action to see what it is, right? So just vary. These are your variational equations of motion. That it is a mass term is already apparent from the second equation, which sort of looks funny because you have started with a theory where F was devoid of any local degrees of freedom, and now suddenly it got a mass term. So what's going on?
The point is that because f is completely antisymmetric, okay, you can actually integrate the equations rather quickly and realize that due to the presence of the mixing term, remember, this is the new feature. Busso-Polchinsky is mu equal to zero, okay? So they will just get f to be a constant up to possible changes due to membrane emission. You turn on mu, you find that f is actually not locally constant. It still has no local degrees of freedom independent of the scalar, but the scalar mixes in. But then you look at the scalar equation of motion, and you actually realize this is a source term. It's just telling you that there may be a source term, a constant source term, okay? But you actually realize it's a massive quantum world.
Intuitively, where would you see it immediately from? You have a mixing like this, but f, the propagator for f, is just a constant. So you have a scalar, then you have an f piece, a scalar f piece, a scalar f piece. But because here the propagator is independent of momentum, it really looks like a sequence of mass insertions. And if you resum the propagators correctly, of course, it would be just a mass term. Yes,
in fact, actually, I'll show you in the next slide how easy it is. In fact, it is very easy.
What you just do, you integrate f out and replace it with its dual Lagrange multiplier. What's particularly interesting about this mass term, though, is it does not break axiom shift symmetry. Okay? That's the magic of this mass term. You see, the point is that if you actually go back to the Lagrangian, right, if you shift phi to phi plus a constant, the axiom changes by a constant times f, which is a total derivative. In fact, actually, you can check that with these boundary terms, properly covariant, by theory, and so on and so forth, even on the boundary is determined. Very interesting question. Let's talk about that.
Well, you know, maybe a mass difference.
Still, you know, I still don't know. I still don't know. But wouldn't that be wonderful? Yes.
But it's just because I have the redefined F transform is not
true. Yes, yes, but still, you know, this is okay. That's a very interesting question.
You know, could you make Higgs a superscalar? Yeah. So basically, you just get the total derivative, okay? And so actually, so this is a mass term, amazing little mass term, which is still shift symmetry invariant. Of course, shift symmetry is actually spontaneously broken on the background. Okay, that in fact is why you get a mass term, once you fix the value of f. Okay? To see that even more explicitly, let's do now this trick of in fact integrating the four form out. So we enforce basically, we go to something like correct Palatini formula, first order formulation for the variational principle, enforce f equals dA as a Lagrange multiplier, complete the squares in the four form, because then it just turns out to be a free Gaussian variable. Integrate the f out, no problem. And we are left with a little action here, which now involves only the dual of the f, which of course is just that, you know, integration constant, the flux, okay? But now, because of the mixing, when you complete variables, you actually realize that the square is complete, okay? And so now you explicitly see the master in here for the phi field. Q is, in this language, Q is just an auxiliary field. Because of the fact that you still have to vary with respect to A, which is still effectively another auxiliary variable. So if you ignored the membrane term, which also involves A, the variation with respect to A would just give you dQ equals zero. So in the absence of membranes, Q would just be a constant, okay? In the presence of membranes, remember, the membrane term is A times the wall volume action on the membrane. It will tell you that dQ is equal to E, E being the membrane charge, across the thin membrane. And that's what the boundary condition is. This is your mass term, and it's now manifestly shift symmetry invariant. Okay? Because of the fact that you have the, you know, auxiliary field to shift, to restore the potential to its original term. But also, you see that it is, therefore, the mass term is irradiatively stable, okay? Because it only turns out to come from the F mixing, all right? But the symmetry is broken spontaneously once you pick Q. the integration function. Okay. Now let's start getting a little bit more serious. Okay. These charges are actually quantized. They're not classical. In classical theory, you could basically take the charge E to be whatever you wanted. So if you chose the charge E to be, 10 to the minus 120 or whatever, that by itself would be the solution of the problem and so on and so forth. You can't do that. It doesn't come that cheap. The trick is that if you imagine the theory that I just described to arise from dimensional reduction of some higher dimensional supergravity, at least bosonic sector of higher dimensional, ignoring the atomic module and so on, the charges are quantized and the units are given to you. The units of charges are given to you by the construction. Essentially, the electric charges, the charges of forms that have non-zero indices in the 4D spacetime, right? All of the quantization rules are given basically in the units of, let's say, assuming 11 dimensional supergravity is the starting point for dimensional reduction, are given by the third power of the, this is a membrane charge, not the 5-ray, okay? So third power of the 11 dimensional Planck scale divided by the wave function and normalization of the form field. If it's electric, you get to divide by 4D M Planck. If it's magnetic, if that means if the indices of the four form are in the compact dimension, okay? Then you divide by the bit of a different form. Bottom line, if you want phenomenology to come out, M Planck is 10 to the 18 GeV. M11 cannot be lower than few TeV. And I'm being, loose now, right? Or otherwise you would have already seen extra dimensions and so on and so forth. The extra dimensional volume cannot be bigger than 0.1, what is it? I heard last week in Cleveland, 50 microns or something like that is now the best bound, right? So, give or take an order of magnitude. And you'll find actually that the smallest unit of charge by which the charge can change with this simple compactification can never be smaller than 10 to the minus 16 electron volt. Okay? That's not good. Okay? Because of the fact that you have to multiply this by 2 powers of m Planck in order to see how much the cosmological constant changes like. So that's too big. That's why you put in many forms. Okay? So you have many forms pointing in different directions. In other words, you have basically some more complicated internal manifold, which has non-trivial non-contractible circles. And you take a bunch of forms that live on different cycles. And then you choose compactifications to be a little bit asymmetric. One dimension is, 10% shorter than the other and so on and so forth. In order to account for the fact that the charges are not integer multiples of the smallest one. And once that happens by continually subtracting numbers many, many times, you can, if you like, it's literally a discrete version of a system that moves on quasi-periodic orbits. Right? It's practically like, Liouville's theorem or some such that, after many, many cycles, you always come arbitrarily close to any point in space. So that's really what it is. Okay, so now, for quintessence, if you want the quintessence to come out of here, then we need that mass term, that unit charge, to be not 10 to the minus 16 electron volts, we need 10 to the minus 33 electron volts, right? Now, so the point is, since we have this mechanism of canceling charges between collaboration of form fields, can we do the same thing, okay, when it comes to actually canceling the charge that turns out to be the effective mass of your low energy action quintessence? So let's start with that. Okay, let's just do the dimensional reduction. Here is your the form sector of 11D supergravity, right? Where you actually have the Chern-Simon term. There was an interesting little comment in Russo-Polchinski. Basically they just ignored this term. Okay? They'll say we will ignore it and not worry about it afterwards. Suppose that you perform a compactification on a 11D space, thank you, which splits into 4D vacuum, you know, Minkowski or De Sitter with small lambda or whatever, times a 3 torus times a 4 torus. Now, choose the following assignment for the 3-form potential of the 4-form. Take a piece that is electric that lives in the spacetime. Take one of them to live, to be a zero mode that lives on a 3 torus. Okay? And then take another one to essentially be dynamical in the second 4 torus. In other words, give it a flux in the 4 torus. Then, if you like, if you just stare at these 3 pieces, all right, up to permutations and so on, this guy, after dimensional reduction and integrating the 3 torus geometry out, becomes the phi field. This guy becomes the derivative of this piece. All right, that's the 4D4 form. But then this guy still survives. It's the derivative of this piece, which is the flux in the internal torus. And that's the new term. Okay, so the theory gives you this. In fact, Dvalli and Abilankin, when they considered this construction, they were getting this term from inducing it by radiative corrections in some theory with Z sub 2n discrete symmetry, which is spontaneously broken, which is a totally legitimate way to do it. But actually, this piece is already there in 11D supergravity. And the only way to, you know, the only thing that you need to do is basically to make sure that you actually retain this structure while consistently being able to stabilize the dilatonic modulus. Anyway, you know already what it is quantized in terms of. That basically, since it's one of the magnetic charges, the formula is given in terms of the previously defined formula, and so on. Now you look at. Yes?
You'll see in a moment. No, in fact, it's crucial that it be different. But you'll see in a moment. Right. This is just the simplest realization. This by itself is not good enough. Okay? The reason is that mu cannot be smaller than 10 to the minus 16 electron volts, and this is what you need.
Okay, so here, all I'm doing is I'm just making large dimensions, but I'm not yet benefiting. I'm just giving you plausibility that, in fact, this comes in from 11D supergravity. I'm not yet telling you how to get 10 to the minus 33. Now, here is the point that you actually now want to use more for. All right? Here is how. Suppose now that, in fact, you have many axions and many forms, okay? And then you have some mixing matrix. All right? So then it's actually still possible and easy to do the same trick of integrating all the 4 forms out. Okay? So you basically get now a potential which is a sum of squares like this. One for each form that you integrated out. In fact, the number of axions and the number of forms doesn't have to be the same. You know, the fluxes are all basically quantized in pretty much the same units, but they don't have to be exactly integer multiples of each other. And you find that, in fact, the system has a mixing matrix. And systems that have mass matrices and mixing matrices are prone to one other little phenomenon in particle physics called seesaw. Okay? So if you actually have mixing of these guys to many different forms, it stands to reason that when you consider the eigenvalues of this mass matrix due to something like seesaw, you will find some eigenvalues which are anomalously small compared to the unit in terms of which this is normalized, okay? And the unit here is mu naught squared because you have the mass matrix to be the product of the two mixing matrices. Here is, and now you have to look for a realization of this. This is non-trivial because of the fact that, you see, the point is that if you have too few forms or couplings to too few forms, then you will not have enough many independent terms in the mass matrix that you can play against each other. Okay? Let me give you an, I'll do better than that. I'll give you an explicit example. Okay? And the, That's an issue of cosmology. For now, all I'm looking for is consistency condition. But in fact, it's not an issue. No, the question is how what the step is. If they're all too light, you can end up having. But even then, you can go into anthropics and so on and so forth. Okay? You cannot ask these questions. You see, once you're in the landscape, okay, you know, you can ask also, is it a problem having too many forms to start with? Right? It's very tricky. I could also tell you something about these Pastor-Marchenko problems. That is also, you know, turns out to have a very, very difficult interpretation here. Yes, let me try to wrap. Okay, here is the explicit example. Type 2B string theory. Bosonic sector only with the forms, right? So you have the Nevers-Schwartz and Kaldramon 3 forms. You have the 5-form cell view. Here is what you choose. You choose, you truncate to 4D in a way that leads to 3 different 4-forms, all electric, coming from the dimensional reduction of the cell view 5. You take 3 axions, which are coming from the B field, from the Nevers-Schwartz field. And you take 8 different fluxes, okay, in the Kaldramon set, with these indices turned on. Ls are the sizes of internal dimension that you're compactifying on. And these Ns are, if you like, the units of charge parameterizing the flux. All right? So this is the setup. These are all independent variables. And now you simply choose them. You choose these, basically, you take one of the fluxes to be big and the other fluxes to change by one front. Okay? This is really the flux of an inappropriately normalized units. This is measuring the size of the extra dimension, and this is measuring the unit of mass in the absence of mixing. So your theory is precisely of the type that I showed you, where now the mixing matrix is determined uniquely in terms of the fluxes. You take the limit n, the limit where n is large, but not large enough to have too much energy density, all right? And you find that, you know, in this limit of large n and large extra dimension in string units, that the eigenequation for the determination of the mass eigenvalues is a cubic polynomial, all right? So, you know, this is actually not so bad if you wanted to go mathematical and historical at the same time. You can invoke Cardano's formulas and whatnot. But it's actually much simpler than that. You just plot the function, all right? You see, you know that this cannot have a tachyon because of the fact that you started with a potential which was the sum of squares. So that's fine. The only question is where the smallest eigenvalue is. The smallest eigenvalue is determined, well, you know, just from the graph, is determined by the cancellation between the terms which are biggest near zero. In other words, the constant and the linear term. And you find your minimal mass. The magic is that you see the minimal mass, okay, now benefits. So it's the unit in 10 to the minus 16 electron volt. But now it gets divided by a large number n, the flux, and multiplied also by a small number, which is the ratio, which is the ratio of the string scale and the size of the experiment. It's seesaw. Okay? And then you basically make sure that you have consistency checks that the four forms, sorry, the three-form fluxes don't contain too much energy density so that you're still in the regime, effective regime of supergravity, that this is, you know, the energy densities are not bigger than the string scale, and that the size of extra dimensions is chosen so as to satisfy the usual Gauss law relationship between the string scale and the Planck scale. And that you are in the V coupling regime of the theory, so that the string coupling isn't, you know, bigger than one. So again, that you can actually thrust the truncation of the full theory down to the supergravity limit. Gauss law formula 0.1 millimeters, string scale a few times 10 TeV, coupling 1,000, just as a demonstration, leads you to the lightest eigenvalue being in the potential. That's it. So it's a proof of existence. Now, again, why would we have that? You know, I don't know, okay? More interesting technical question, I mean, why would I end up, you know, in a theory where I have lambda to begin with? Well, I don't know except for the entropy. One way to show whether this is more prevalent than W equals to minus 1 is to actually have legitimate constructions. If you had legitimate constructions, if you were able to show that everywhere where lambda effective was small, you also had a flat axionic direction due to the fact that you turn on the mixing term thanks to the presence of some extra 4 form, then you see the moment is, if that's true, if there is always a flat direction associated with a small net value of lambda, then there is a much broader regime in phase space to sit not at the minimum but someplace away. You can protect it from strongly coupled gauge theory easily. I'll tell you details if you want them later. And you have to, basically you have to make sure that, you see, if you couple to some gauge theory, there will also be usual instanton correction. Now, if instanton correction, they can be big for the large values of phi. But if they are normalized to a small unit compared to the background value obtained by the mixing, then they're negligible. They'll just produce a little bit of extra wiggles on top of the flat potential. Let's summarize. So what do I really want to tell you? Basically, what I really want to tell you is that the mass cancellation is really a four-form misalignment. So the same rules, the same ideology, actually tells you that the moment you end up with a vacuum that have a lot of, you know, the theories that where there is vacuum with small net values of vacuum energy that looks like cosmological constant, you will also have contest. Okay, the trick to getting this is a combination of low string scale, okay, and seesaw. Obviously, you will be able to get this from if you increase the string scale but put in many more fields, so that in the seesaw type construction there is many degrees. In other words, with bigger mixing matrices, so you can play one against the other. The possibilities, you know, are numerous. I'll just end up with this. So it's the job's on you.
Wouldn't you also get fifth forces from this?
Not from the axioms.
It's not coupled to
E dot B. Axioms only couple since they're pseudo scale. They only couple to E dot B. And this nature has been, you know, incredibly generous to axioms by making them really invisible. It hasn't been that generous to us. Although I should probably announce a paper that should come out later this week, hopefully, under the title String Axiverse, where we are discussing the ways of detecting invisible axioms.
Yes, sir. Can I ask again a phenomenological concern? So
sure.
So these guys are not, they don't have a pressure potential. So
no.
They're just basically massive scalars with massive mass. So for most of the history of the universe, they're displaced by at least n Planck for their minimum. And so my worry is that if you have, presumably as n is very large, you have more than one of these guys.
In the setup, I'll answer you exactly why this is not worrying, at least in the term model setup, which I've discussed with this construction of type 2B. You have three axioms, and obviously, therefore, you're going to have three different eigenvalues. Okay, so you see the funny thing about the axiom is that, you know, it doesn't come alone. Which science fiction movie said it always comes in pairs? In fact, this one came in triplets. All right, they're equally split by the units of 10 to the minus 16 electronvolts. So if you get an axiom which is 10 to the minus 33 quintessence, it's just the seesaw. Okay, it's just the seesaw. It's the geometric mean. All right. One of the axioms is 10 to the minus 33. Another is 10 to the minus 16, which is actually interesting to me for another reason, because that guy is the one, that's the mass scale that is in the sweet spot for dimming supernovae. All right? That's the axiom photon mixing. It operates with the axiom at that mass scale. All right? And the third axiom is a millimeter. So these are, you know, the millimeter one, I think, can probably be entropically constrained. But the point is, they're not all going to behave like dark energy. Some of them may behave as dark matter.
So the guy which is 10 to minus 16 eV, if it's displaced by n Planck, then when h is somewhat
exactly correct, will start exactly correct. Exactly. And in fact, that guy, that one definitely dilutes with f's which are of order n Planck. In fact, as we now seem to believe in string theory, f axioms will never be bigger than n Planck, right? Now, maybe not everybody shares that, but I think most people actually do. At least, let's put it this way, in what we know about string theory so far, it was impossible to get f axiom to be bigger than m plus. So if you take f to be not bigger than m plus, even if you displace the axiom originally, okay, at phi of order f, okay, then you actually can check that because it comes out of slow roll early, by now it dilutes tremendously. But yes, generally, if you really want to make, you know, I mean, otherwise you would have to constrain. If it's lighter than 10 to the minus, I think the anthropic axiom can be dark matter is like 10 to the minus 20 like the volts or something like that. But I don't remember.
So this is not to some overlap with the Andrasian people like Easter and Orsted did, right? Also, they have this axion, diagonalize the spectrum. Eigenvalue close to zero included.
Yes, so this is this pattern. You see, the reason I don't believe in that actually being the right measure of probability of finding such things is the following. If I actually use this pattern Marjorie distribution, probability for, you know, distribution of eigenvalues and so on and so forth, I'll actually, you know, straightforward application tells me that in order to find this thing, okay, the probability will be H of the universe now divided by m plus square, time, 10 to the minus 120, right? That is telling me that the probability of finding an axiom which is very, very light, okay, in the current universe is practically zero. Yet I know that most string theory compactifications give me massless axioms by the bucket. Okay? So, you know, if this probability distribution tells me that as I'm going towards zero mass, it's going to zero and then suddenly jumps up, something is wrong there. I don't know what it is, I just, you know, don't see how this probability argument in fact applies. Because, you know, it's probably what you normalize for instance. But I'm less, you know, less curious about it. The one thing that this is in a sense more related to is the monodromy business. Because actually, the point about this is that it's really, what happens is, after the spontaneous breaking of symmetry, okay, generated by the choice of the value of f, the axiom, the originally this field was a periodic phase of something, right? But now, in fact, it learns that there is a potential. So it prefers to be on one of the branches of the covering space, as opposed to the other. So it's really, I mean, you know, I think Eva Silverstein, in some of our discussions, christened this flux-based monodromy. I'm happy with that. It sounds good.
Okay, let's go to coffee and continue the discussion over the coffee. Thanks.